Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Yes, the roaring crowd cheers on another edition of Pollock and Thurston. Here we are as the cities of Toronto and Buffalo converge on the pro wrestling industry. How are you today, Brandon?
I'm good. Did you get that press release? I think just after we recorded last week's episode about there's a border war happening. There's some sort of TNA sponsored show that's happening in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Sounds like using tariffs for heat.
Yeah, it seems. I think based on my anecdotal evidence would be. I think a lot of pro wrestling promoters have the idea that, oh, this will be a lot of fun. There's a lot of angry people up here that I don't know how well this show will go over, even amongst wrestling fans. But hey, why not? Let's go stage a show right in Niagara Falls. And
the Border Brawl, May 25th at the Niagara Falls Convention Center on the Canadian side. Don't come over here to the U.S. side because who knows if you get back in. But yes, what is this? Zonify presents TNA-produced wrestling event, The Border Brawl, where diplomacy ends and body slams begin.
Oh, my God. I love it. What's pro wrestling? Always rising to new lows. We have plenty to talk about. Front and center, we got 35 minutes of Mark Shapiro. I think we're going to go line by line. We'll just summarize Mark Shapiro at the J.P. Morgan conference. You know, the man that is front and center by no mistake.
He's a huge AAA fan, too, I learned.
Huge. I mean, the guy is, a closet lucha aficionado, a regular Rob Bihari is Mark Shapiro.
I want to see, let's have Rob Bihari and Cubs fan and Mark Shapiro get together and, do some kind of podcast or, review. They should go back, just to promote the big Worlds Collide show. They should do a retrospective look at when Worlds Collide from 1994 together.
Yeah. Talk about the Perro Aguayo brand.
Yeah.
In Mexico. The merchandise opportunities. I would love that.
The Gringos Locos. There's a lot of relevance there for today's culture and back then.
All right. Well, that's the Trios podcast that we can definitely get behind. Maybe we can have conversations. We are also going to be getting into some of Brandon's breakdown on whether we're going to go to arbitration in the Janelle Grant case. We're not waiting on Sarah Russell anymore.
Today, yes.
Brandon's going to determine if this is arbitration ready, all that and more. But I did want to start off just a little bit. We have talked a lot this week about the passing of Sabu. And I'm just curious, Brandon, from like your own kind of discovery of Sabu, if this was someone that was a guy you were acquiring tapes on or finding out about? Was Sabu a part of your kind of fandom of pro wrestling in the 90s and into the 2000s?
I was thinking, I listened to your audio, which everyone should listen to, about the Sabu story and just a great look at his life and career. But I'm trying to think like when the first time I would have heard the name Sabu. And I think the first time I started to really open up my view on wrestling was probably through the wrestling simulator TNM, specifically TNM 7. Anybody else out there familiar with that? And because you just saw like in text all these names, ECW was this thing that was emerging to me in like probably 1998 by the time I heard about what ECW was, despite the Bert Flickinger Center in Buffalo having ECW events by then. But you saw this name, you know, named Sandman and Sabu. But I probably saw him first turning on Empire Sports Network to watch like the late night ECW TV shows. My first Tape Trader tape was a Best of Hayabusa, like sixth generation, probably a dub of like an RF video best of or something. And that does have the Sabu versus Hayabusa match. You know, and you see Hayabusa was kind of the gear, at least minus the mask, was very much an inspiration of Sabu. I think I thought it was the other way around, but no, he was Sabu with a mask, basically, in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it was like for us here in Canada, we got no ECW until the TNN deal, but definitely I got exposed to him just through the magazines. And I think the first time I had ever come across his name, I thought it was maybe a confusion with, is this Samu? No, this is Sabu. And he just bloody pictures of him that really were just tailor-made for that kind of magazine circulation, but more so when, you know, for tape trading and with the advent of like wrestling on the internet now, like he was like a pretty key figure, I would say, and just people seeking out different types of wrestling. And now you sort of had these channels of communication that you could transfer a lot of this stuff, but between people and come across it, going beyond television and magazines. And I think in that era, you know, he was somebody that was a real force on the independent scene and very key to ECW's early identity that I think is a much different identity if you don't have Sabu there in those formative years.
Yeah. I mean, listening to your story this morning, I thought, you know, in a lot of ways he embodies in his era, what was really interesting about pro wrestling and all the good and the bad ways. Like he was part of this wild hardcore style. There's, you know, including up to, you know, a few weeks before he passed. I mean, if people have read the story from Phil Schneider for Yahoo Sports about, you know, what was happening with him right before he had his last match at WrestleMania weekend. But just, you know, a lot of the intriguing and exciting and hardcore and crazy things, and a lot of the excesses too.
Yeah, I mean, you can really go through. There's a lot of lessons to Sabu, and they're not all positive ones. Like this was not some flawless individual by any sense. With a lot of the stuff he said, a lot of the things he introduced to professional wrestling, there was lots that you can take away from it. But it was sort of this kind of outlaw image that he was able to persist with when pro wrestling was going further and further away from that. Like he was kind of caught between, you know, the principles of his uncle and that era that he learned about pro wrestling with a totally different industry by the time we're into the 90s. And this is the furthest thing from the territories and where a character like him could just go from territory to territory and have a very, could make a lot of money. And this was a guy that, you know, did not leave pro wrestling with any significant money.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what shows I was on that he was on, and I'm sure there were a couple, or at least shows that I was at and kind of helping out or working at. I remember one show in Niagara Falls, Ontario. This would be many, many years ago now, where like it was, I think it was a Neo Spirit show. You know Neo Spirit.
Yep.
And he just like on late notice came to the show and did a signing, didn't wrestle, but just showed up and did a sign. It was just very random, very, very Sabu-like to just show up and make some money.
Well, if you do want to check out my piece on Sabu, it's up at postwrestling.com, both written and audio form as well. from Sabu to Mark Shapiro, yes. The ultimate transition. Mark Shapiro spoke at the JP Morgan conference. What would you say about Mark Shapiro's activity on the conference scene? Is this approaching George Barrios 2017 levels, or is Mark Shapiro still in the shadows of Barrios, who I feel was the leader in this domain of just attending any conference that would invite him?
Were there some random ones that George Barrios did back in the day? I'm trying to remember, because there's a basic run of them, which is like what Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan. I remember back in the day, before there was Lightshed, there was the BTIG conferences. That
rings a bell.
But I don't know. Maybe there are more random ones that he could be doing. Maybe he could be doing more conferences. But I think any media company, which DKO is making the vast majority of their money and their revenue in media, are getting, if they're a big enough company, are getting invited to these things. So it was Nick Kahn for a little while, and now it's Mark Shapiro taking over.
Well, one of the major topics coming out of this was Mark Shapiro explaining their strategy towards live events. Of course, WWE has greatly reduced its level of output when it comes to live events on an annual basis. So here is a clip on Mark Shapiro talking about this strategy and also what their goals are regarding their profit margins. Is TKO profitable enough? Not quite.
And I would just tell you that... that we cut those house shows down, so now we're doing 200 events a year. So we've cut them 75%, the number of house shows that we do. And we feel that's a good place to be, but we'll continue to prune as we go through. WWE has tremendous upside in global partnerships, tremendous upside that we're already realizing on ticket pricing, tremendous upside with site fees, dynamic pricing, yield management, all areas we're really focusing and pushing in on as it relates to live events. And as you see from our first quarter, our margins significantly expanded as it relates to WWE live events. When it comes to free cash flow conversion, we're sitting at, north of 60%, even with adding on location PBR and IMG, which are lower than the other properties we have. We're still going to be north of 60%, but we're not going to be happy until we're knocking on the door of 70%. And that's an internal goal that we have. And the quicker we get there, the better it'll be for our shareholders.
Yes. So there you go. That explains all of your cuts that you're going to get on a semi-annual basis. How, explain the 200 events per year breakdown. Like, we are incorporating NXT into all of this. I guess that gets you closer to 200, but I would say like they're not even hitting 200 when you factor in, I mean, maybe it's in that ballpark at least.
If you count NXT house shows, which like I have the question, are those even happening, or are they happening to the same extent? I'm scrambling to pull up my list of WWE events by year that we have at WrestleNomics.com, but it sounds like he's willing to cut more, and that was the engagement of the day for this call. I took it as kind of a passing comment, like he was more trying to say, look, we've been so successful, we've made it so much more profitable. And I kind of feel like, in this era where WWE has become a media business much more than the live event business it used to be, not seeing the event-by-event breakdown, because believe it or not, publicly traded companies don't have to reveal every single aspect of their company. I have to assume that they analyzed this and looked at the individual events, and especially those smaller market events, and saw that those were not profitable or slimly profitable, and that there was a better margin opportunity in doing fewer house shows. Last year, by my count, 176 events last year. So yeah, under 200.
Yeah, I think we're almost at like the bare minimum, I think, of shows that they're going to run. I guess they could like U.S. domestic house shows are almost completely gone outside.
The big question is, do they do those domestic house shows in December like they always do?
That's the big run of house shows. And I think it would, those are the ones that I think ultimately they're looking at.
Because they've done no domestic house shows so far in this calendar year. None. They've done six international that were part of Raw and SmackDowns that they also did internationally. And they usually don't do international shows that much in Q1. But if they, the thing that I'm looking for is, do they do any this year? And if they're going to do any this year, it's going to be in December.
What would you look at if you are, you know, it's one thing if you're a Randy Orton, and I think like for a lot of the talent, there's going to be no complaints about this. They're making incredible amounts of money for fewer dates than ever. But for your talent that, let's say, are those talents that are on the bubble that you could see come release time, you can take or leave whether they would stay there. Is this a good thing for talent at that level that is just being called up that, say, has, you know, 5 years in the industry? It's less shows, therefore less demand for that depth of roster. Like, what are the negatives from a talent perspective for this? Because we focus on the positive of just less wear and tear, and you can make that argument, but it does come with a cost, I think.
No, it's less experience, right? I mean, I think there is always the risk of injury by putting more miles on wrestlers' bodies, but there's lack of experience that you're getting by not wrestling more often. Maybe, I don't know if this is something that they're really strongly considering, but you look at their relationships with Noah and now with AAA. We're seeing that to some extent with some developmental talent or like Omos, who's not being used, being sent out there. But I think that's something they could do, is use those partners to send talent out to get not only more match experience, just more matches, but a different style. I know that's something that WWE's usually not into, is exploring different styles and allowing people to learn a different playbook. But I think you look at the history of wrestling, and that's almost always, I always enriched somebody's ability as a performer.
Yeah, like I look at somebody, for instance, like a name that just comes to mind is a Cora Jade, who at one point I think everyone saw as like this is someone that is main roster bound, seemed to have has an independent background, and then has that injury last year that took her out for like 9 months or so. She comes back, and it was very evident that you had a performer that the division had evolved greatly, and you were not seeing her at that level that was at the front of the class, and they make the decision to cut her. And you look at that fact of like, well, how many matches is she wrestling post-injury? You're limited to TV shows, and they're still doing NXT house shows, but they're in a lot less frequency. And yeah, when a Julia comes in and you look at like what her last 5 years have represented, yeah, you're going to be leapfrogging a lot of talent. And if you're a performer in the likes of a Cora Jade, like you're A, coming off of an injury, and B, just not getting the requisite reps, people are going to be surpassing you. So there is going to be that give and take for a lot of performers, given what your situation is in the company and what level of experience you have. But I think there are many younger performers that are going to have to look at the idea of, when I sign that WWE deal, is like, what is my experience level? And like, what am I going to be looking at schedule wise if I still have that development phase that is not complete yet?
I think about like, if you're advising somebody who WWE was willing to sign, let's take for granted, they're putting a developmental contract in front of this person, and they have a little bit of wrestling experience somewhere non-WWE, but only very little. Like, would you advise that person to take that deal and then go into the performance center where they'll work for only who WWE allows them to work for, or continue to develop their skills outside of WWE for a lot, maybe less certainty? But I think you have to look at the now what 14-year track record of the PC, and it's not like there's this great track record of performance center talents who came in with very little experience and became great wrestlers. There are exceptions, but those are the exceptions. This has not turned out to be the Harvard of pro wrestling schools, as you know, maybe it was supposed to be. It's turned out to be like the Walmart of wrestling schools, where you know you can. It's put out the Bianca Belairs and things like that, but it's fewer and far between. And I think there's more than a decade now of track record to say, if you want to become a great wrestler and make a great contract with WWE, maybe go everywhere else first before you're ready for them to get the best out of you.
Yeah, and that becomes its own tricky balancing act, because everywhere else is, you know, contracting in many ways. Like out like you have a Game Changer Wrestling that runs like a pretty intense schedule throughout the year, but we're talking about like,
well, contracts expire. Contracts are usually about 3 years or so.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there is no Ring of Honor. There is like TNA.
There's a Ring of Honor. Oh, don't make Tony Khan come on here.
You're right. A Ring of Honor that is coming to the local Toronto vicinity anytime soon at the Ted Reeve Arena. But that's, you know, that's an interesting aspect. But I think overall, I think that the live events, like, that is not something that I have sensed like there is this demand from your fan base. Like, as much as we talk about like these smaller cities that they're not going to, it's not like that seems to be a big complaint among fans. The complaints you see is that, okay, when I can go to an event, I'm just priced out. That seems to be a more vocal response, but that is kind of part of the strategy here. Less shows, higher demand, and therefore we can limit our supply and the demand goes that much higher and people will pay these amounts. And that formula, it's working, and it's working on the UFC end as well. And yet both sides, you have these complaints about quality and pricing, and the market is stating otherwise from reaction you might see among, you know, your diehard fan base that is adjusting to this strategy.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not, it's not just about supply and demand, but it's about quality too, and that people are embracing WWE in these last 3 years a lot more than they were for the prior three.
So when the merger came together, the upward guidance of cost savings was going to be $100 million. So how does Mark Shapiro feel they have hit that target?
On the global partnerships front, we put out a target of $375 million for the year, and I feel confident that we're going to hit that. We have an incredible momentum. And then you move over to the other side of the fence on really cost containment. I think that my CFO, Andrew Schleimer, and I said that when we brought it all together, TKO, that we would realize a net savings of $100 million. We blew through that.
Blew through it. Cost containment. That's Mark Shapiro's jam.
We translate that. We laid off even more people than we thought we were going to be able to.
We could have kept so many more of these people, but we didn't have any desire to. Me and Schleimer, we rolled up our sleeves. Cost containment. That's what we do on a Friday afternoon. So yeah.
Now, it's not all that, but it is largely laying off employees.
It's a huge part of it. You know, there's redundancies in production areas and different, but what are redundancies? We had two people doing this job. Now we have one person doing this job. I mean, that is the appeal of a lot of these kind of large scale mergers that is very enticing to shareholders. And I mean,
we hear from employees that they've been given some UFC work to do. WWE employees who used to only work for WWE, as TKO has merged, they've got some UFC work put on their plate at times.
If you came in as a WWE consumer to work at your dream job, well, I hope you're up to date on the latest in UFC and professional bull riding, because I'm sure you're being tasked with many areas of the company.
I haven't heard that yet, but that was a concern, yeah.
Here is Mark Shapiro chatting about the pending Peacock rights.
We're not afraid of multiple partners. Look, it's funny. From a business perspective, I think that it makes a lot of sense to have multiple partners and maximize the financial opportunity and not put all your eggs in one basket as it relates to the marketing opportunity for your brand. Having said that, as a viewer, I can't stand it. All right, I have to do too much homework to find out where my game is on a given night. But guess what? That's the world we're living in. And you know, if you're going to be in sports, you have to be prepared to play in that world. As it relates to the WWE, we're up at the end of March next year, as you said. WrestleMania for 26 will be our first big event with our new partner or with our current incumbent, Peacock. And we're having conversations with Peacock. They want to extend. They've been a fantastic partner. We're not in a rush on that one. So it's again, brand and dollars. And what's best for our fan and what's best for our investors. Those don't always line up seamlessly, but they're close enough, and you know, we're anxious to get in that conversation, to further that conversation, I should say. You know, we're kind of having parallel tracks here with the UFC and the WWE right now.
So not too much movement on either the UFC or Peacock front, but interesting to hear from Mark Shapiro actually convey his thoughts as just a consumer.
Doesn't like it.
I hate
all
this.
Yeah, he wants all his UFC to be on one network as a consumer. But when it comes to shareholder value, well, that comes first.
Yes, as you could have gone from this past Saturday night's UFC card to watch the early prelims on Fight Pass, move on over. The first 40 minutes were on ESPN2 because of a delay, then to regular ESPN for the final hour and 20 minutes of the prelims, and then you can spend your, $15 for ESPN Plus to get access to spend $80 to get the UFC 315 pay-per-view, then send you back to ESPN for the post-game show. I mean, that's an easy navigation for any sports fan that by the end of a 7-hour card is probably half in the tank.
Yeah. As for the Peacock rights here in the U.S., as we know, subscribers have grown over time. This service that started reporting subscribers in late 2021, and they're up to 30-some-odd million subscribers. And I think some of that is attributed to having those WWE rights right from March 2021. But Peacock has not been one of the big winners of the streaming wars. And this was last updated, and I think they've got another quarter out that I haven't put in this chart yet. But look, this Peacock has lost a lot of money. It is not profitable, even when using the custom adjusted EBITDA metric. You know, they've lost, what is this, some $10 billion, roughly?
Got to break some eggs, Brandon.
So do they need, you know, how many subscribers are they going to lose if they don't renew WPLEs for the $200 million a year that they're currently paying for it, let alone what they might have to pay for it if they renewed it? So I would think, considering these things, the winner of the streaming wars, Netflix, who would like to be able to sell advertising for Raw along with PLEs, might bid more aggressively.
Yeah, I think over the next year, it will be really interesting to watch where a Peacock and ESPN Plus move, and if these services have kind of topped out at what you can expect. Like, ESPN Plus has finally shown like a slight decline in subscribers in this last quarter, and they're introducing their flagship
reporting ESPN Plus. Last I looked, they just quit reporting ESPN Plus subscribers. I could be wrong about that.
They're doing
Disney and Hulu. This is Disney's IR, of course.
Okay, I have to double check this one. But ESPN, though, they are also introducing their flagship service later this year, which will be called ESPN. They're naming it ESPN. Yes. So that's
no brand confusion. ESPN is a strong brand. People are saying this is what HBO should have done instead of this Max and HBO Go and HBO Max and HBO Plus. Just call it what it is.
We also have a rebranding of another streaming service we'll get to later at today's WBD upfronts announcing as well. But let's finish off here. One more from Mark Shapiro here when it comes to our favorite topic, site fees, and dropping a hard figure on what they're getting for two nights in New Jersey for SummerSlam this coming August.
And when you just talk specifically about site fees, if you want to go there,
yep.
Like you've got... I mean, look at WrestleMania 41. We had a meaningful site fee and in-kind from Las Vegas. And I would just tell you, we've just finished our economic impact study, or we're just putting the finishing touches on it. And that study is showing we drove $320 million to the city of Las Vegas for WrestleMania 41. When you're doing Royal Rumble in Indianapolis for 2 days for a meaningful site fee, when you're going to New Jersey this summer for SummerSlam, and they're paying us $7 million. And this is the meaningful opportunities here. Perth, Australia, where we're committed to doing multiple events over the next 2 years with the Western Tourism Australia. And then, of course, in June, we're going for multi-million to Baku, Azerbaijan. So these aren't just like run-of-the-mill, you know, around the corner Kansas City. These are, you're looking hard and fast, and we've got an entire team dedicated, not just on the government relations side, because you need to have these relationships, but boots on the ground in these different cities to uncover who wants to pay to play.
Poor Kansas City. Saints system run of the mill, Kansas City. This is Azerbaijan in Baku. $7 million for SummerSlam. How does that compare to some of the other non-Saudi Arabia site fees that WWE has commanded over the years?
It's the biggest one we know of. It's WrestleMania in Las Vegas. It's $5 million. Well, plus we did learn that they got some tax credits, a couple million more in tax credits. But what we know of the other SummerSlam that we have to compare it to, we don't have a super recent one, but the most recent one that we know of is SummerSlam 2021, also in Las Vegas, where they got $330,000. Now they're going to get. Now it is a 2-day event. Maybe they'll get double. Maybe they'll get like $700,000. No, $7 million.
Yeah, that's an incredible amount. And we know in the past, UFC has been able to get dollars.
Oh, yes, they have.
From New Jersey as well.
The New Jersey Sports and Exhibition Authority or something. Exposition? They're getting, I think, something like $5 million for their events.
Yeah, they got a fee last year. And for this year coming up, they're going there on June 7th for their next pay-per-view as well. So, I mean, on the site fee front, I mean, this has been obviously a big, big initiative for them. I can only imagine what this amount is that UFC is getting to go to a place like Azerbaijan. But I think like that one is probably one where you're looking into, you know, I don't think quite Saudi Arabia level, where UFC got $20 million last year for a fight night card. So that tells you like what Saudi Arabia is paying for a UFC event, and we know the amount that they are getting for traditional PLEs from WWE in the $50 million range, and what the ceiling is when we're talking about a Royal Rumble event next January. And on that Saudi Arabia front, we did get the confirmation from WWE of Night of Champions that will take place at the end of June, on June 28th, and it seems now that the pattern is that you'll have a TV piggybacking off of the Saudi Arabia show. They're going to do SmackDown on Friday from Riyadh. This is the first time they've done a SmackDown in Riyadh. And then the following day's Night of Champions card takes place.
And just real quick about the site fees. He didn't really get into it in this talk, but he has in others. The notion that there's an opportunity for site fees around Raw and SmackDown. And I think there is on a supplemental level. But the notion that, you know, every Raw and SmackDown that doesn't have adjoining shows to it within the TKO universe, the notion that a standalone Raw in Buffalo is going to attract a site fee sounds pretty far-fetched to me. But there is a supplemental value when you're attaching it to a PLE or you're attaching it to another UFC event or PBR or whatever it is. But the notion that, you know, there's going to be Raws and SmackDowns every week attracting site fees, I would be very surprised.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's going to be very special circumstances like that we have next weekend when they go to the Yuengling Center in Tampa and you have, what is it, Saturday night's main event, an NXT Battleground show, Raw, and a Tuesday night NXT that we don't know what the amount is that they're getting. I'm sure it would be on the lower end of some of these fees we're talking about, but I think that's the idea of creating multiple nights of events with the hope of that being a value. But I think those ones are going to be like the idea of getting fees for a Raw SmackDown in the US specifically. I think those are going to be fewer and far between.
My sense is it has to be a show where that people are going to travel to, because then you're bringing not just your local population in, but people from outside the area too, to spend on hotels and things like that.
Well, maybe it's a different flavor of professional wrestling. And we know, based on Mark Shapiro's comments last week that Brandon has isolated here, we know a huge Lucha fan is one Mark Shapiro. And here he is with Nick Khan gushing over their recent acquisition.
I'm digging into some detail here, but I'll tell you, I am really excited about this. This is an opportunity that, frankly, that Nick and Paul Levesque unearthed. This is a major property in Mexico, an enormous following, avid fan base, extremely young.
If you look at some of the recent wrestlers who came into WWE, Penta and his real-life brother Phoenix in particular, both social media impressions, Penta on his debut, almost 100 million social media impressions. You see a spike in Latino viewership when he comes out. It's something we noticed a few years ago when Bad Bunny came in on his run with WWE, was that the Latino audience would be there if there was someone like them who was there.
First week we came out of the gate with Penta, when he first debuted, you know, he led all merchandise sales that week. Just new to the party, and he was number one. So we're looking to mine these opportunities everywhere. Obviously, this is an established league, but to the latter part of your question, nothing else on the horizon from an M&A standpoint, if you will.
Nothing on the horizon, but man, he's an excitable guy. Okay, I've never heard
he loves
Mark
Penta.
Shapiro.
I had a few takeaways from that. Is that so? What he's addressing there at the end is that the analyst was asking about whether there are other things like this down the line, which I took to mean, are you going to buy other wrestling companies?
And yeah, the analyst was clearly a NOAH supporter and was concerned.
Clearly was worried and didn't want to see Kitamiya misused. I wouldn't rule it out, but they're not going to do anything. You know, I don't see him downplaying that as like, oh, they're definitely not going to though either. And it made me think not only his excitement over Penta, he had to jump right back in there and talk about how great Penta did with the merch sales. But putting the promotion over so hard, even though, yeah, they bought it and now it's their own. I imagine like if this had happened under Vince and they had bought AAA, I can't imagine Vince putting over AAA as this super hot property that is a wrestling company on the same globe as us. And putting it over so hard, just the notion that any wrestling company would you know, hold a candle to WWE is not a framing that I think we would have gotten under Vince.
Yeah, Wei kind of brought this up last week talking about it, and it was almost kind of unique here to hear Mark Shapiro, that we so often just associate him as just like the numbers guy and the
and he's clearly like he was running UFC too, and now he's newer to WWE.
Yeah, this was like a guy, like there was a certain excitement level that I would never, like, when do you ever recall a Vince McMahon ever showing like just a bit of like love of this industry? And I'm not even saying it in like a derogatory way, but just like he never came across as like this would be someone that would follow professional wrestling if this was not like his.
It's not professional wrestling.
You're right. He didn't even have a care for the name of it. But, you know, that was always a thing, was it like this guy showing like any level of fandom of the product that he creates. That was, I think he really enjoyed the creation of it and the production of it and being that type of person. But as someone like, could you imagine Vince McMahon in these last couple of years sitting down and he's just watching professional wrestling for leisure? I'd have a hard time imagining that.
I would like to watch some tapes with Vince and see what he really honestly thinks of professional wrestling.
Do you think he's just gone down a rabbit hole and he's getting like
maybe he's discovered YouTube recently, and maybe he's getting on Daily Motion even for that matter.
He's watching old like St. Louis tapes. I'm sure he's going down the rabbit hole of Sabu this week. Yeah. I mean, like that is one thing, like Paul Levesque and Tony Khan, like in this generation of the two biggest companies, like these are clearly two people that at their core are fans of professional wrestling. And I wouldn't go so far as to imagine Mark Shapiro is your big wrestling fan, but I think he at least conveys like a passion for this that you're definitely not going to get from an Andrew Schleimer or an Ari Emanuel.
Yeah, he's an excitable guy, and that's why we're such big fans of him.
Anything more on the Mark Shapiro front, or the it's been 6 days since the earnings call, and that feels like a long time ago. Was there anything else that you were left with from
not
the
remarkably
earnings report?
I did want to mention from the JP Morgan talk with analyst David Karnofsky. Karnofsky asked him about sponsors and sort of setting him up to talk about their growing sponsorship business with WWE, but he also put a caveat in the question of have you gotten any pushback from fans about whether it's too many ads, which was a big talking point coming out of WrestleMania. He talked about how
they did promote the fact every match, the 14 matches, every match had a sponsor for this year, that they were touting that as an achievement.
Yes. And he said things to that effect and didn't address the latter part of the question.
Yeah. It was like, Mark Shapiro does not strike me as someone that like that. You may as well be talking to him like you have three heads coming out of you. I mean, he just that part of fandom does not compute with the man. It's like there is an empty place on the mat that is untapped real estate. So, yes. Let's move on over to a story that Brandon had up this week on the site. A Connecticut state court judge has denied Dr. Carlin Kolker's motion to dismiss a petition filed by former WWE employee Janelle Grant. The ruling that came down this past Monday makes way for Grant to pursue evidence from the doctor and clinic whom she says Vince McMahon directed her to get treatment at. And it does become a little bit confusing of the different suits that have been filed contrasted with petitions that have been filed as well. So can you compute this, explain this to us, Brandon? What is significant about this?
I was trying to do a timeline today of all the various litigation. We should isolate that as a clip too. Mark Shapiro saying he's got some litigation that he's going through on CNBC. In any case, there's something like 8 lawsuits that either directly involve Vince or don't directly involve him, but are sort of sprung out of the Janelle Grant situation. So this is involving not the big case that we often talk about, which is in federal court where Janelle Grant is suing WWE Vince and John Laurinaitis. This is a separate state action that technically is not a lawsuit, but it is a legal action. It is a legal case where Janelle Grant is trying to get, is trying to conduct discovery on Dr. Kolker and on Peak Wellness. Dr. Kolker has pushed back against it, is tried to get that case dismissed. There's a dispute between the parties about whether or not all of the medical records she has requested have been provided. Dr. Kolker says he's provided them multiple times. Okay, but he tried to get this case dismissed, and the judge made a ruling finally on this. When was this? A few days ago? Friday, I think it was. Monday. This is Monday? Time flies. But it was not granted. It was the motion to dismiss was denied.
So from this, we add this on top of the defamation suit that Carlin Kolker filed last week against Ann Callis.
Yet a separate case, yes.
Separate case as well, yeah.
An actual lawsuit.
Yeah, this is going to need its own subreddit forum, or at least some graphs at the very least to keep in charge. CW president Brad Schwartz did comment to Variety about NXT coming over. He said, quote, "It's been an absolute game changer for the CW, and I think it's been a game changer for WWE. He says, "This last quarter has just ended. It was the highest rated NXT quarter in 5 years. It's up 19% year over year." Schwartz also said that WWE and CW are constantly discussing new ways to expand their relationship, including additional WWE programming on the network. CW has already moved to get NXT talent involved in other programming across their slate, including Tony D'Angelo appearing on the procedural Wild Cards and Trick Williams making an appearance on All American. In adults 18 to 49 and 25 to 54, we're regularly beating Fox on Tuesday nights. It's unheard of, Schwartz said. So it's been absolutely crushing for us. It's one of the big reasons why our network as a whole is up 40% season over season. Besides animation on Fox, NXT has the highest concentration of 18 to 49 and 25 to 54 on all broadcast. According to WrestleNomics data, NXT was up 18% in overall viewership in the first quarter, up 2% so far this year in quarter two, and was even in 18 to 49 in Q1 and is down 25% so far in the second quarter.
Is this from the Variety article?
No, this is my addendum, okay, that I'm putting at the end of this.
But what we're showing here on video, if you're watching, I think really speaks to that, is that, look, CW is a broadcast network. It's got pretty big reach, but it is a lower profile broadcast network, well below the leading four. And NXT is delivering viewership that is much higher than anything that the CW network is used to. And you can see the gray dots here, that's NXT, and all the green dots is everything else. And you've got other shows, you know, things like Trivial Pursuit and Police 24/7 and All American. You know, they do half or less than what NXT does. It's far and away their number one show.
Yeah, and he is not exaggerating when he states, like, when you go through first of all, like, broadcast television, I mean, it is showing you as well, like, a great reduction in a lot of these larger networks. But yet there are certainly weeks that they are outranking Fox's primetime programming on Tuesday nights. And even there have been weeks that NXT's like 18 to 34 numbers get like several spikes in them throughout those 2 hours as well.
You're looking at the half hour data from Programming Insider?
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. You can break down all the half hour data that Programming Insider provides. But I mean, it's been, I guess it goes to what your expectation level was of NXT going from the USA Network to CW. Yes, it is a move from cable to broadcast, but I would say like USA Network is a much superior platform than CW is, and clearly CW seems to be exceptionally happy with NXT's performance.
I mean,
so
in terms
far.
Of the viewership they're able to deliver, it's pretty much on par. The 1849 is down, right? It's down a little bit from where it was last year for the most part, but the total viewership is actually up, which probably tells you something about the age composition of people who have access to CW versus USA, or at least those who are using it.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply.
All right, next story, we have the latest residency announcement for AEW. So we talked last week about their 7 shows that they have scheduled for the 2300 Arena in Philadelphia in late August and into September. They have now announced 6 shows that will take place in July in Chicago at the Byline Bank Aragon Ballroom, which lists a capacity of 5,000 dependent on what their configuration is going to be. But this will take place between July 16th and 31st. So this will immediately follow All in Texas. And we will see 3 episodes of Dynamite, 3 collisions, including 2 Thursday night editions of Collision. And yeah, following the trend of these residencies that AEW is obviously looking toward, and a more sizable venue than the 2300 Arena, which is probably going to be around 800 or so that it can be set up for television. This, you can get probably several thousand into this arena.
And they didn't do multiple shows. They did multiple tapings at the Manhattan Center. Is that right? Do you recall?
They did 2 nights at the Manhattan Center, as
two,
I recall.
2 nights, and that sounds right.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would be, and now I know that's New York, and there might be high expenses involved in that, but maybe they would do something like that. I'm thinking about, you know, they're doing the ECW Arena, a residency there. They did their residency earlier, when was that, a year ago? July?
Summer?
In Arlington, and mm-hmm. They're doing it again. I'm sure this is keeping expenses down, but it tells you that it was successful enough, and it was probably enough of a cost savings that, you know, if the attendance isn't going to be, you know, well over 3,000, you might as well get the costs down and do these extended residencies and tape your TV this way. And this is probably the way to go, as opposed to, like, you know, being at the TNA Asylum, where you're wrestling in front of the same fans every single TV taping, or doing, you know, 4 weeks of TV at once, where you kind of like wear out the fans, but you do have some loyal fans and things like that, but still being able to tour around the country with it.
Staying on the AEW ticketing front, tonight they are doing Beach Break at the Now Arena, just outside of Chicago at Hoffman Estates, where the very first All In took place. WrestleTix is reporting that they have just cleared 4,400 tickets distributed, which will make this their largest TV attendance so far this year, ahead of the recent show in Norfolk, Virginia at the Chartway Arena. On top of that, The tickets went on sale last week for Forbidden Door at the O2 Arena in London, England, and they have distributed nearly 12,000 tickets already for that show, which is going to make that, you know, a very successful outing for them as they return to England. Not doing Wembley this year, but probably the right call going to a venue of the size of the O2 Arena. Is there anything to glean from some of these more successful figures for AEW? And do you sense any big takeaways here from these ticket movements?
I don't know. That's good. Have you seen anything about ticket prices? I mean, the degree to which you sell out right away is going to be influenced by the price of the product. But
I did sense, like, I didn't look at the exact pricing, but I did hear from people that, like, these were pretty significant prices the way they had set these up for
Forbidden Door. I hope so.
Yeah, for Forbidden Door. Yeah.
I don't feel like, oh, this means that they're still going to be able to draw 50,000 fans in Wembley Stadium when they go there in 2026, mm-hmm. supposedly, right? But that's good. It's encouraging. It's better than being, you know, only a few thousand moved at this point.
Do you think that the Forbidden Door concept itself is still, like, that is a key to the, if this were, say, just your, if this was AEW full gear going to London, England, do you think
it would still be pretty strong? Maybe not as strong as this, but I think it being in London is the biggest factor there.
Mm-hmm. So then we have as well, Brandon's recent article that's available now, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, entitled, "Will Grant v. WWE Stay in Open Court or Go to Arbitration?" This is the several million dollar question that Judge Sarah F. Russell will have to rule upon at some point. She recently was allowing of the amended complaint to go through. And Brandon, as you wrote in this article, the defendants are due to refile their motions to compel arbitration by June the 13th. So they have about a month to refile those motions, which we expect all of the defendants to do. And Grant will then have an opportunity to request evidence related to the arbitration question and to submit a written opposition to the motions. My guess would be we are further and further away from a decision being made, and probably hundreds of filings away from a decision being made. But I think you did a really good job here of trying to look at kind of precedent and breaking down what the arguments have been on Janelle Grant's behalf to avoid our arbitration, as well as the defendant's argument of why arbitration should be the venue. And I think you're, you know, it's a very good breakdown, I think, of just some of the variables that Judge Sarah Russell is going to be leaning on when she makes this decision. And with the caveat that Brandon Thurston is not a attorney, but
I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice.
But he sometimes plays one on a podcast.
Yes. So the issue that we're facing is, people, I think you just explained, right, is that they're litigating whether this arbitration clause that was part of the NDA, whether that's going to be enforced. Arbitration is the separate private process that, you know, critics would say it favors powerful defendants like WWE and like Vince McMahon. So they're litigating that, and to overcome that, you have to prove that this arbitration clause was unconscionable. And strap in. We're going to get into the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm about to talk about Justice Antonin Scalia, who's not even alive anymore. He ruled, he wrote the opinion in 2010, in, as everyone remembers, in Rent-A-Center v. Jackson. They ruled that if you're going to overcome a motion to compel arbitration, you have to show that you were under duress or that you were deceived about the arbitration clause in particular. Not just the NDA, not just the contract as a whole, but that there was something special about the way that you were deceived about the arbitration clause. So, like, if, for example, they had some dispute in the course of negotiations specifically about the arbitration clause, that would help Grant's case. She hasn't alleged that. So, like, as I was telling you off air, like, even if Vince McMahon had held a gun to her head and said, you have to sign this contract, if there wasn't something special about the supposed unfairness about the arbitration clause itself, it seems like, according to that precedent set by the Supreme Court, that it's going to be very difficult for her to overcome, or at least to prove that she was under duress as it concerns the arbitration clause itself. So in lieu of that, There are public policies, perhaps, that one could look to if you're such a plaintiff and say, well, this public policy makes this arbitration clause unenforceable. As we've talked about in the last couple of years, there's been a great deal of discussion about the Speak Out Act, which invalidates non-disclosure agreements in cases of sexual misconduct. As it turns out, reading the law this week, trying to get my law degree. No, not really. The Speak Out Act went into effect December 7th, 2022, and it is not retroactive. At the very bottom, it says this is only applicable to cases on this date and forward. So I don't know if the Speak Out Act really applies in her case. In any case,
a reminder, Janelle Grant signed her NDA at the end of January 2022.
Right. But what there is the Ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act, the EFA, or EFAA, which was enacted on March 3rd, 2022. So as we've discussed sometimes in the past, they signed this NDA on January 28th, 2022. Grant does allege that she was assaulted one more time. She doesn't put a date on it, but sometime between February 10th and March 2nd, she was assaulted one more time in the last time that she met with McMahon in person. So that's right before this act goes into effect. But she does continue to allege after that, she was texting with Lesnar, and before that, she was on the phone with McMahon, and she alleges that McMahon, directed her to have sex with other men, including Lesnar. So she takes these texts that are in March, which are now after the EFAA is in effect. She takes these texts to be, as she alleges, part of the coercion, part of the control that she was under. Purportedly, these would be part of the sex trafficking that she alleges that she was subject to because of McMahon. Those things happen after the FAA are in effect. Now, the defendants have already anticipated this, and they've already addressed it. So, ironically enough, the defendants are the only ones so far who have mentioned the EFAA. And they say that these allegations are not substantial. These allegations are not actionable. I take it what they mean is that these aren't allegations that one could, on their own, standing alone, sue over. So that has happened. And I also would point to, which she does mention in the complaint, that on June 17th, this is 2 days after the Wall Street Journal has for the first time broken this news story that the WWE board is investigating Vince McMahon for alleged sexual misconduct, and there's an NDA of millions of dollars involved. And so 2 days after that, someone on Twitter tweets her name, and she alleges that that's a result. She says it's on information and belief. So, which basically means I believe this happened, and I believe evidence will show that this happened, but she doesn't really know for sure. She alleges that WWE leaked her name. Now, the person who tweeted this does attribute it to, yes,
yeah, just cites a WWE source for right. that. And Grant's interpretation is that this was leaked by WWE, but again, like it is both in that instance and Lesnar texting Janelle Grant, it seems like the onus is on the plaintiffs here to be able to connect this to Vince McMahon in a certain way, that this was that Lesnar was contacting Janelle Grant per the permission of Vince McMahon, per the orders of Vince McMahon, and similar to this news leaking, that it was a coordinated effort. And that is what the plaintiffs are going to have to be. Like, the texts in and of itself are not going to be enough to substantiate that.
And she does allege that she texted explicit pictures to Lesnar on or about March 4th, which would perhaps tie it to the sex trafficking in that this was, as she alleges, this was part of a contract negotiation with Lesnar. Lesnar's a WWE contractor. Maybe this was even part of an exchange of Lesnar services to WWE in exchange for not only monetary compensation, but the sex trafficking that Vince was providing for him. And in any case, and then you have the leaking of her name to the media, and that she alleges is part of retaliation and part of something to intimidate her. Okay. But the issue here is that, well, most of this alleged misconduct occurs before that law is even in place, and it's not retroactive. So all this has got to go to arbitration, the defendants would say. But then what I was talking about before is, you know, unless there's some case law that really backs this up, that there's some case law that would be favorable to her situation, I think this might go to arbitration. But then I found this case from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court that, you know, hangs the umbrella over Connecticut and a few other courts, including the Southern District of New York and the Eastern District of New York and a few others. And this case of Olivieri versus Stifel, which is this financial firm, and it involves this employee named Patricia Olivieri, and she alleges that, you know, she was subject to sexual misconduct and sexual harassment. She had this boss that was acting very inappropriately and subjecting her to sexual assault and sexual harassment. She alleges that she went to her boss's boss and tried to get it handled, and it kind of only made things worse, and it didn't get handled, and she went to human resources, and she alleges that she was being treated differently, her leave with her paid time off was being docked in ways that other employees pay time off was being docked, was not being docked. And so she alleges all of this. It's all alleged to have happened before the EFAA goes into effect. The judge rules on it. This is in the Eastern District of New York. The judge rules on it and says, no, you've got an arbitration clause. It's in your pre-employment contract. Sorry, this has got to go to arbitration. That's made like weeks after the EFAA goes into effect. The EFAA is in effect, and a couple months later, I think they just didn't know about the law existing. And a couple months later, they look at it again and say, you know, we want to amend this complaint and argue that the EFAA allows us to avoid arbitration. And the judge looks at it a second time and says, because of the continuing violation doctrine, because there are allegations of retaliation that take place after the law is in effect, this is all part of one episode, and under the continuing violation doctrine, you've got claims here that are after the law is in effect, so therefore, this arbitration clause is invalid, and this can stay in open court. The defendants, this financial firm that she works for, which I think she still works for, says, well, we're going to appeal this, we're going to take it to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals looks at it in August of last year and says, no, the lower court got it right. This is valid, that it's under the continuing violations doctrine, that this is part of the same episode, and you do have claims that accrue after the EFAA goes into effect. So the issue, the way that this would be relevant to Grant's case, is that she has these allegations that occur not only after the NDA is signed, but after this very relevant law goes into effect. Now, why this court and this case in particular are relevant is this is the court above the Connecticut District Court. This is, if this case were to have some appeal, it would be going to this court, and this court is binding authority for the court that Grant's case is in. If it was just another district court, just another federal court that was a pure court, this would be persuasive authority, which is not as powerful. But this is like the judges above this court saying, yeah, this is how this law should be interpreted. So nobody's talked about this case. None of these parties have talked about this case. This is just something I found. So,
well, hopefully they're listening. If they can successfully argue that Janelle Grant was coerced into signing this, would that eliminate this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe there's some argument there, but under Rent-A-Center v. Jackson, you've got to have some unfairness that pertains especially and unequally to the arbitration clause. It's not enough that I make you sign an NDA under duress. I have to make you agree to the arbitration clause under duress in a way that I didn't make you agree to everything else about the contract. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It just seems very, it would seem very hard to be able to prove.
It's like we discussed this contract. I'm going to have you sign an NDA, and we haven't put an arbitration clause in it yet. I really want to have an arbitration clause in it. You're okay with it without the arbitration clause, but then I put a gun to your head and say, we're putting the arbitration clause in it, sign it. Then you can invalidate my arbitration clause. Otherwise, right. I'm compelling you.
Well, I think that this is it's really interesting because I was not even aware of this EFAA, because so much of this is focused on the Speak Out Act and the Trafficking Victims Protection Act that have been cited over top of this. And it seems like this is much more relevant to this case. And the fact that you found this, you know, case that is fairly germane to the Janelle Grant case, I mean, it at least gives you an insight onto what some of the thinking may be here towards us. And
it raises questions about Speak Out. Like, does this mean that Vince could try to hold her to the non-disclosure? Well, I think the fact that there are allegations of misconduct after the agreement is made, the agreement's language is pretty clear about the notion that this covers everything on and before the date of the agreement. She would still at least have those post-agreement allegations that she could talk about potentially, that she wouldn't be, I don't know if she'd be liable for any of her statements, but it does seem to complicate that. I did not realize that until the other day, that Speak Out Act is not retroactive, and it's enacted months after, some 11 months after they made their NDA.
Do you look at the fact that rather than the text from Brock Lesnar and this alleged harassment from Vince McMahon after the NDA was signed, that beyond that, Vince McMahon's decision by February 2023 to not make the second payment, was that, do you think that was an error in terms of how he responded to this becoming a public story? Or do you think that that is something that will be validated based on his belief that the NDA was broken and went public with it?
Well, he decides not to pay her because he believes she has broken the agreement.
Yes.
By disclosing. He believes that she is responsible for the board finding out about it, which causes the board investigation. So thereby, Vince believes that she told someone. If she didn't write that email that is supposedly from a friend herself, well, she told the friend and broke the NDA that way. Now, you've got a number of other allegations from Grant's side about, it seems like Dr. Kolker knows about this NDA, and he's certainly not someone who's mentioned, who's allowed to know about this. Is it a mistake? She probably doesn't sue him if he continues paying, right? Because you want the payments to keep coming.
That's the overriding question, but I don't know. That was my thought at the beginning, that he pays this.
He's already resigned. He's already been under investigation. The scandal is broken.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that might be the case. I don't know. I don't know if that's ultimately where this goes. But I mean, just specific to this is that, like, does Vince McMahon have the evidence that Janelle Grant broke this NDA? Or did he, by not paying, he was the one that initiated the breaking of this NDA?
If there's discovery that could be conducted and you could find communications records of her disclosing the existence of the NDA or anything else that would violate the NDA to someone else at the, you know, earlier than his actions, then he could show that. Now, if does that exist? I don't know.
Anyway. We're getting very much into the weeds on this case. Like, it's a lot of just like dense details to this, but I mean, it's going to come down to the interpretation here. And I think ultimately, that's going to be the decision that the judge makes here, is based on the fact of whether she feels like this is, if there's enough protection here for Vince McMahon, WWE, and John Laurinaitis to uphold this NDA, and it goes to arbitration. And I think it's you can certainly do all the deductions in the world to try and get to that conclusion, but it's going to be, you know, you can argue both sides extensively.
Yeah, I think she has at least a moderate case that she was under duress in sort of a legal, you know, reaching a legal standard. It seems like the precedent is it has to be to overcome arbitration, not just invalidate the agreement, but to overcome arbitration, that you have to have something that specifies that clause. And that's certainly what the defendants are arguing.
Last things here. Let's go through the weekly numbers here. SmackDown on Friday night, they did 1,455,000 viewers, up 3% from the week prior, and the 18-49 demo up from a 3.7 the last week to a 4.1. This was second for the night in the demo behind the NBA playoffs, but ahead of the Maple Leafs Florida Panthers game. You know, the Leafs aren't used to winning anything, much less cable numbers on a Friday night. Thursday special edition of Collision, 382,000 viewers and a 0.09. So compared to the previous Saturday, they were up 12% in viewership and up from a 0.06 to a 0.09, and ninth for the night on cable, which was featuring one NBA playoff game, one NHL playoff game. I would say this many examples we have of the Thursday night Collision, it is not showing
it's on a different network too. This is on TBS.
That's right. This was on TBS as well. I just thought that when I think that the idea of like a Wednesday feeding into Thursday is much more palatable for AEW. I think there's a lot of advantages to it. But thus far, with several of these examples, it's not like we have seen Thursday is this much significantly better night than a Saturday. But it is still, we're going to get more examples of this, obviously, throughout the summer of running these Thursdays.
Yeah, I tend to think you'd be avoiding a lot of the competition and the WWE shows that are always on set. Well, they're often on Saturdays and the Saturday night's main events. It would be harder to counter program for WWE, at least.
And expense wise, I think it's a lot easier to run two nights.
True,
in
and then
a
you
row.
Could run live and you could run back to back nights somewhere. Yeah,
and you have the same talent that. In theory, you'd have all of your major talent available for both nights instead of necessarily having to decipher between a Wednesday crew and a Saturday crew. And then we go to Raw on a week ago Monday, doing 2.8 million views on Netflix, 5.7 million hours viewed. So this ranked fourth globally. It ranked in 20 countries, including third in the U.S., fourth in Canada. And we did get backlash ranking in 21 countries this past Saturday, including Canada, Mexico, India, the U.K., and Ireland, but did not rank globally. So that means it was under 1.6 million views from Saturday. But yes, those are our weekly rankings for Netflix.
Yeah, pretty standard raw number.
Yeah, that's the headline. All right. And today was the WBD upfronts. And what did this mean?
What does this mean for AEW?
That's the question. We had John Cena appearing alongside Tim Meadows to preview the next season of Peacemaker and the announcement that they are rebranding Max to become HBO Max this summer.
Again.
Yes, HBO Max is back.
God,
they just they can't come up with a straight branding strategy, but they are back. What does that mean for AEW?
Is John Cena gonna appear in AEW?
John Cena appears at AEW adjacent event. Should that be the headline today?
But see how that does in views. Let me know.
Yeah, did you hear? John Cena, man, dude, you need this photo and a Mark Shapiro. They are, this looks like AI Mark Shapiro. I've never seen this image of John Cena before. John Cena was also, he was getting questions from the media. Did you catch any of his?
No, I'm not aware of any of this. I knew the upfronts were happening this week, but I haven't heard any of this news.
Well, I didn't know that this question would come from Us Weekly, but here's John Cena, and tell me if he sounded like he was caught off guard.
Surprised when the reaction from WWE fans when you said that you still love Vince McMahon?
No, because everybody's entitled to their opinion. Mm-hmm. Just like I'm entitled to have an emotional connection to somebody. Yeah. I don't hold anybody or how they feel or what they view as permissible or things that'll make them angry, happy, excited, sad. That's their right as a human being. I'm not surprised about any of that.
I did hear about this. Clearly, John Cena views Vince McMahon like a family member, and no matter what, he's gonna love Vince McMahon.
Do you feel that? It does feel like John Cena is. I mean, he is certainly maybe in of WWE performers that are in the spotlight the most. It does feel like this follows him the most. But on that same front, when we look at that New York Times article that came out last month, I mean, his words were, I don't care who hears it. I love Vince McMahon. I mean, he has, if he is looking at the fact of, being asked about this all the time, I do feel like you have, you've really been like, you have planted your flag and it is going to elicit questions. even ones of like, were you surprised? I mean, basically just wanting to hear John Cena talk about this. But I mean, it's, you know, I think Cena, he's very clear about his thoughts on Vince McMahon. And that's an aspect to someone that is interviewed by a lot more mainstream press than a lot of your talent are on the WWE roster, many of whom, quite honestly, don't have the relationship with Vince McMahon that John Cena does.
And look, I mean, of the people who have spoken about this publicly, his views are far from the median of how people who worked with Vince, talent who worked with Vince in the past, have reacted to the news in the last few years. You know, he's pretty normal in terms of former WWE wrestlers who are like, yeah, I still appreciate Vince.
Well, everyone, we have come to the end of today's program, so we thank all of you for joining us. And we are going to be coming back tonight with Rewind to Dynamite. I will, with Wei Ting. So we will be chatting about Beach Break tonight. Are you going to be taking in any Beach Break tonight, Brandon?
Chances are low. Should I?
Or are you watching Game 5 of the Toronto Maple Leafs and Florida Panthers?
I might put that on. Yeah.
All right. Two more chances to watch the Maple Leafs this season. So take advantage of it while you can.
What's the series? What's the who's ahead?
It's 2-2.
It's 2-2. Oh wow.
Leafs blew their 2-0 lead. So yeah, the season finale of the Toronto Maple Leafs is coming up on Friday, most likely. So you have that to look forward to, Toronto fans, and then. All the hatred that comes my way this time of year, crickets next week, folks. It'll be crickets next week, so I'll look forward to that. On that note, Brandon, what's coming up in the world of WrestleNomics?
I just want to say that I do hydrate quite a bit. We have Derv who says, Brandon, I love you and your content, but please start hydrating more and get some sleep. I promise you look so vibrant and healthy if you hydrate more. And I have to tell you, this is just the way my face looks, unfortunately. I drink seltzers all day, non-alcoholic seltzers all day long. And there's just these natural bags under my eyes that are a gift of my genetics.
Well, I think you look very hydrated, Brandon. I think that you're taking in your requisite dosages of water on a daily basis, but we appreciate everyone's comments on our looks. They always that doesn't keep us up late at night at all with insecurities and
no,
desire to be better. So thanks to all of you folks out there for
as long as you sign up for the Patreon, I don't mind at all.
Yeah, then have at it. Okay, so let us go. You know, there's lots of great fans out there. We appreciate all of you. All right, that's it for us. Thanks you for joining us. We're here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Pollock and Thurston. That wraps things up. Goodbye.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money, like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.